Hello everyone and welcome back to the Knee Down Podcast. My name is Matt Grant and I'm joined with my esteemed guest, as always, Craig Dickinson. Craig, thanks so much for being here, mate. I love talking to you and so do the listeners like hearing you. So how are you and are you ready for today's podcast?
Yeah, I'm good. No, I'm really well. A little bit hot, but yeah, really good. Let's crack on. Interesting weekend.
So a bit of context for the viewers watching now or listening on Audio Boom, wherever you may be. Craig is currently in Spain because he's just been at the Circuit Navarra with the IUM Motorsports team at the ESBK. So a quick mention, how was the weekend for you guys and how was it?
Yeah, it was a great weekend, actually. So it was our first time as a team as well as Declan as a rider to the circuit. So, yeah, we just basically started from scratch and built our way through it steadily. And, turned out with a great result. Declan got P5 and P8, so we can't complain with points, and he just made improvements every session as well. So hopefully, I think we're back there in 3 weeks' time, so got a good base to work off and get him a little bit further up the grid.
He's a good lad. Of course, Declan been here on the Knee Down podcast with yourself in the past, and of course, I interviewed him as well a long time ago. So, Declan von Rosmalen, a feature on the Knee Down podcast quite a few times now. But let's talk MotoGP. So, back in action in Brno, over 200,000 fans were in attendance to witness Marquez pretty much dominate. We had a dominant Moto3 winner in the form of Jose Antonio Rueda, a surprise Moto2 winner, didn't see that coming, I'll be honest, which we'll get to later on, but there's still quite a lot to talk about. Now, first things first, Craig, I asked you last week, and asked the fans, what lap times would we be seeing in Brno? Now, you and I have been texting over the weekend talking about this, and we almost saw a 51. We actually saw the 52s, but Craig, take the floor. What, can you believe those lap times?
No, because I said high 53s and Mark near enough nearly did a 51 before crashing. But yeah, crazy. Doesn't surprise me, but yeah, not where I would have thought they would have gone. But it just goes to show how much they've developed. Not only the bikes, but the tyres, the riding of those bikes as well, like the riders individually, come a long way. Yes, it's not every day you get to see that kind of level of a comparison. So, and yeah, race, everything was quicker. The race lap was quicker. The qualifying pace was quicker. They did struggle a little bit. So I reckon going back next year, they may even comfortably be in those 51s, because if you look at their practice, they had a lot of rain, which, you know, disrupted the dry time.
So I think I saw somewhere a while ago, and I forget what track it was, and I forget who covered it as well, actually, but I'm certain that I saw that there was a 5-second improvement over the last 5 years at a certain track, and it was Pecco Bagnaia with also a certain track. I'll have to look into this a little bit further, but it's probably not unrealistic to think that we will find that 5-second improvement if Brno stays in the calendar. But with Michelin changing to Pirelli's, would things change? Think we'd see quicker lap times? Of course, a little bit difference in the future as well with different times of bikes. Maybe we won't see the 150, maybe 151's a ceiling?
I mean, they've said that there's not going to be much difference in the smaller engine capacity. And from experience of the Pirelli's, because we run them in ESBK and Junior GP, they are phenomenal for one lap. It's just you have to manage them over the course of the race. It's not that they're bad over a race. It's just that I remember the technology came in Formula One where they were basically asking for tire degradation specifically. So Pirelli have that capability to make a race entertaining in the least.
That could be very interesting because I think we are lacking a little bit of entertainment value for MotoGP at the moment. Notably, just because one rider is so much dominant compared to the rest. But it would be nice to see something like that in the future. So a little bit of a change. But I guess we'll stick to talking about Saturday, and then we'll move into the Sunday's Grand Prix as well. We'll discuss all the categories. But first things first, then, what was going on in the MotoGP sprint with that tyre pressure rule? Confusion amongst the riders. Marquez slipping backwards, waiting 3 seconds or so for a rider to actually pass him, so then he could pass him back. And what was going on? Even Pecco Bagnaia apparently had a glitch. He didn't need to stop and worry about tyre pressure.
Yeah.
What's your take on this?
So, I mean, Italians and electronics, right? Never really worked before and obviously didn't work this time. That's a joke before the Italians get offended. Yeah, it's a really interesting one because a lot of kind of fan sentiment was, Michelin are ruining the sport, this tire pressure rule is ruining the sport. The reality is, Mark and Pecco were the only ones on the grid who had the warning and the indication. That's not a tire or a tire manufacturer problem. That's a team making the wrong decision. Now, I think for a lot of people at home, maybe what they don't realize is that your tire temperature, when you set it, it's at one point. Then when you put it on a tire warmer with heat, it expands, tire pressure changes again. Then when you're out on track and you're, as Mark was, breaking his own clean air, got cold air blowing onto the tire pressure changes again. Or if you're like Pecco, you're behind a rider or behind two riders. That heat's coming off onto the front tire, which again is changing the tire pressure. So it's not an easy thing to just say, oh, well, why didn't they just set it right when they went out? You have to make that calculation of, especially now that there is a minimum rule, you have to make the calculation of how much it's going to raise, how much it's going to go down. And yeah, it's caught Mark out before in Chang, I think. I think they were happy with the tire pressure setting and miscalculated that in the race he was going to be on his own. So, and that's the reason why he tucked in behind his brother, and the same reason he tucked in behind Pedro. And if you notice, he didn't just tuck in behind Pedro, he stayed as close as he could to Pedro to get the maximum amount of heat onto the front tire to reestablish like the 60% minimum. And that was an interesting one because I don't think Pecco's ever had that issue before, and it very clearly looked like he didn't know what to do. Because he didn't just drop one position, he dropped two and then got beat up for the third and then kind of didn't know how to come back through. Like the way Mark did it was, you could write a textbook on that for, yeah, younger generations. So, yeah, I think Michelin deserve a little bit of slack on that side of it because ultimately the two red bikes were the only ones who had the issue with it.
And the other ones that were under investigation never were actually penalised. There was only those two. But at the end of it, Pecco wasn't under investigation. It was, he claims it was a glitch. There was an issue that he was shown incorrect information that he should never have had to drop that position.
Be really interested to see if you were to take all the electronic wiring out of a MotoGP bike, how long it would stretch. And I'm sure it would surprise a lot of people. Like there are so many components involved in modern day MotoGP now, and so many electronic components that, yeah, sometimes things can go wrong, and it's just a bad day at the office because of that. But it didn't affect him tremendously. It could have probably been a P2 or a P1 fight. I don't think anyone was on course to beat Mark, but Pecco definitely could have given Pedro a little bit more of a fight in the race.
Yeah, it was definitely a surprise because obviously gesticulating straight away that he was frustrated with the situation, talking about that the error shouldn't have even happened. It's very strange, and for a team so prestigious and so dominant like Ducati, you think that they always dot their I's and cross their T's. You would never think any gremlins would come in to play for these. But as you say, this is not the first time that Marcus had to do it. He also suffered the penalty in Jerez, so I think he also had a 16-second penalty, if I'm not mistaken. And I think it has happened before, but or he plays the waiting game now, where he'll take his time, sit behind the rider, allow that pressure to build, and then get to the front. But you've got to just say, I mean, from Marquez's perspective, what you said exactly there was bang on. It was a textbook. If that is going to happen, you take your time, you sit there, and to be fair, you basically toy with the rider in second. And that's what he
Yeah,
did.
pretty much, yeah. And yeah, I mean, worst case scenario for him is he forced Pedro into a mistake and would have had to fall behind the Neya. Like, needed someone else to be in front of him. But yeah, I mean, it's something that happens. At the end of the day, there's humans working, riding the bikes for a start, and humans working on the bikes as well. There is an element of human error in all things that we do. And sometimes it happens. Usually when it rains, it pours, and it did this weekend in the sprint race for Ducati. They had the tire pressure issue for Mark and then the error for Pecco. So I'm sure they'll look into that, and I'd be very surprised if we even hear of that kind of thing happening again, like the error in particular. I think the tire pressure is going to be there until we switch to Pirelli.
I think so too, but as you say, if you play it right and you are aware of the situation, what you need to do, then it isn't really a problem, because then you can be so fast and just make sure that you bide your time to be quicker. But in this case, Mark was following a KTM. What would be it like if he was following another Ducati in the form of Alex Marquez or maybe Pecco or even Bezzecchi? Because Bezzecchi was no slouch this weekend. Of course, Sprint wasn't quite as successful, but he was still right up there. But before I move to Bezzecchi, I guess we've got to talk about our KTMs. Did you expect to see not one, but two KTMs on the podium this weekend? We discussed KTM will do well, but podiums?
No podiums, and you know, even we said just before, even Paul was up there fighting to make a decent name for himself, you know. And Brad came back as well, decently. So I knew KTM would be in with like a dark horse outside shot. I didn't expect it to be like that. And most definitely did not expect Bastianini to be the one leading. You know, not leading the charge, but at the front. That was very surprising, and I guess just answers a lot of critics. I'm sure that we'll all go, it only happened one race. Well, now he's got like a good platform to build on.
Well, for Andrea Bastianini, something I wrote here and something I think I saw, and then maybe I text you about it, actually, as a matter of fact. I can't remember, but I know I've had this conversation regarding Andrea Bastianini's Ducati knowledge at circuits. All those tracks he's ridden on so far, he's had the Ducati GP24 in his mind on how to tackle these tracks. How much of a bleeding effect, should we say, will transition to moving to a new bike? Would you always transition back to what you think works because it worked to that bike? Or is it a case of you just got to adapt and forget about everything? And is that what could be happening to Andrea Bastianini this season?
Yeah, I mean, and definitely so, because if you look at some of the articles that were coming out in the first couple of races, they were trying to bolt the Ducati settings into the KTM, like the geometry and the configuration of it. So he very much did not want to give up what he had with the Ducati. But at some point, yeah, this is what I was saying to you just before, is you can end up chasing your tail all year trying to find the perfect setup to be what you want. But ultimately, the bike is a bike and you just have to ride it, find your way around it. And this is what we say with Mark, you know, he's unbelievable at riding through problems, around problems. That's what it takes to be an 8-time world champion. And you know, who am I to say that the other riders need to take a leaf out of that book? But you always want perfection, but you don't always get it. And yeah, I mean, look at what happened to Bastianini this weekend. I think that's a very good point. I don't think he'd been there on a Ducati.
Nope.
And he turned up to a track with no previous background, no previous history. And this is the best we've ever seen of him on the KTM. And I mean, like, we're talking, he has been, for majority of the year, at the back of the grid, the back of the field. What saved him this year is his tyre management. But outright pace, he just has never been there. And yet, here at Brno, where he had nothing to fall back on in terms of, you know, riding experience from before on the Ducati, he delivered his best results on the KTM.
I think the patented tyre management is not something that Anea will ever lose, so he's always got that to fall back on, which is evident, because there has been a couple of races this season we go, how many positions did he gain? What, that's pretty impressive. But you say, that there's been no Ducati knowledge of this track. His last experience here was a victory in the Moto2 race with the Italtrans team. And obviously, that's a much different bike to the RC16. But clearly, he's not picked up any of those Ducati habits. And if I'm not mistaken, I do believe Jack Miller had this experience where they wanted to Ducatify his KTM, but it just didn't work. So then when he started to embrace what Brad was doing, they then had the double podium in Jerez, for example. So I think you might be hit the nail on the head there, because I do recall reading about Anea's settings and the way he wants to ride the bike is not how he should be riding it. And probably that's what we've got to give credit to Maverick Vinales for, because he can adapt to the different bikes. He's been on the Suzuki, he's been on the Yamaha, he's been on the Aprilia, and now he's on the KTM and he's getting good results. So maybe we do need to give Anea a little bit more time before we decide to get the pitchforks out and have him removed from the KTM. Yeah, maybe there is some light at the end of the tunnel. Do you think there is a chance of him staying there now? We're making...
Yeah. I mean, I don't think KTM are in any kind of position to replace it. in that I don't think there is another rider that they can acquire and meet their demands, sort of thing. So I think this will be kind of, you know, what happened with Martin. When Bez started pulling in results, Martin started seeing what was possible. And now Ineos pulled in those results, Ineos started seeing what's possible. What I do find really interesting, and this is more of a grab your tinfoil hat, is the KTMs have really struggled, except for Maverick Viñales, of late. And the one race that Viñales isn't riding, all the other KTM riders did all right. So maybe they're only giving Mav the special parts or something.
I was thinking, maybe, there's no evidence of this, but I was thinking, I wonder if they gave Enea Maverick settings.
Possibly.
It could happen, you know, it's a little thing like that.
Yeah. No, I mean, as far as I was aware, KTM have not been shy this year in terms of throwing whatever they could at it. And at one point, I think all four riders were on a completely different version or spec in terms of aero or chassis. And so, yeah, maybe what they've all done is gone, okay, what Maverick's got is working. Let's figure out how he's doing it and just run what he has.
And it was definitely nice to see Pedro Costa up on the podium this time. I think we skipped him a little bit by jumping to Enea Bastianini, but that was a bigger shock to see Bastianini on there. But Pedro Costa is disappointed this season in himself and in anything in general. He's not had the season we expected, you know, from being the wonder kid last season to, I don't want to say mediocre, it's very unfair to say, but just average. That's not what we expected from the Moto3 and Moto2 champion. But to see him jump on there, to perform in both the sprint and the race, and not just accept that, oh, this is the first podium, but be so self-aware that this has been a bad season. It's not been good. We're looking to strive further. We know we can't beat Marquez. But, and just having that self-awareness, because I think Pedro in the past has come across a little bit boisterous. But I thought we saw a mature Pedro Costa this weekend, where he felt like, you know, no jokes this weekend. We've done it. We've done well this weekend, and I'm proud of what we've done. But we've got a lot more work to do. Do you think there's an extra fight that gives to the rider, or is it a case of KTM, you know, supporting them more? Or what do you think could be from that?
I mean, look, it was a big race, and there's an even bigger one coming next for KTM. But we saw the new CEO was there, and I've heard rumours that the new owner, parent owner company is very keen on the racing side of things. And the wildest rumor I heard is that KTM Racing have basically been given a blank checkbook to sign Marc Marquez.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you want to be the best, you have to buy the best, right? But I don't know how much of that is rumor and speculation. It meant a lot to them and to the team. You know, you got to remember, like you said last year, Pedro was incredible for a rookie on a bike, was showing up the more seasoned riders, not just on KTM, but on other manufacturers. And this year, consistently, KTM have sort of been at the bottom. Honda and Yamaha have made bigger inroads. Aprilia have done not too bad, even better of recent, and there's someone there that we should definitely mention, not just Bez, and Raul Fernandez, the moral champion, did amazing this weekend.
Yeah, I actually have been, out of all the riders, I found that maybe Raul Fernandez is one of them I would replace. I'm not a big fan of just getting rid of riders after one or two seasons, but I think Raul's done enough seasons now to really say, are you going to reach that potential that we think you're going to get or not? But you know what? He's on his best season currently. He's had multiple top 10 finishes, and he's matched his best result of the season, best result of his career on the Aprilia. And I'm seeing a different side to Raul. I really am. I'm seeing that, you know, this is someone who got embarrassed by Ayagura to start the season. All the Aprilias got embarrassed by Ayagura at the start of the season, yet now we're talking about Raul Fernandez actually being a consistent top 10 finisher. Top 10 in the sprint, top 5 in the race. Yeah. I think that's a very worthy point.
Saw his speed in practice and I thought, okay, flash in the pan. And I saw he was in qualifying too and got himself a good grid position. And I said, okay, well, yeah, maybe he'll get a top 15. I was, with all due respect, just expecting him based off of previous form. But he was there and he was racing and like you said, showed he deserved to be there in and amongst that particular crowd at the front.
I totally agree. I made a little post about Raul Fernandez on the Knee Down Instagram, and I'm quite proud of it, so I hope, hopefully you guys have seen it and you enjoyed it. But I guess we'll swiftly move on, because let's talk Sunday. I think Sunday is obviously the big day about every single week, and Sunday makes no difference here. It's still the biggest day of the week. But let's just briefly talk a little bit about Moto 3 and Moto 2, because Moto 3, Jose Antonio Rueda, untouchable, unbeatable, a bit like he was in Chang. But there's something I have to bring up, because I think it's kind of funny in a coincidental way. Last week and this week, I did a YouTube short from us talking about David Muñoz's maturity and improvement. And we really felt that this is a new David Muñoz. No mistakes anymore, no fannying around and causing errors and messing with other riders in the first session. Was it qualifying? I think it was, or maybe practice?
Yeah.
Lifts off the throttle, yeah, in front of about 20 other riders. What's the plan? What's going on, Craig?
Yeah. Look, if it was anyone else, I think nobody would have really batted an eyelid. But yeah, of all the times and all the things to do. But you know what? He again. It's when I saw the penalty and then I saw his result, I was like, maybe that's just like a rite of passage, that you have to start from the back of the grid or pit lane and pass everybody to announce yourself as like a talented rider. So maybe he's just getting that out of the way. But yeah, we're going to have to see how he goes on for the rest of the year. But I definitely think he would have learned from that. And, you know, you never know what goes on inside their minds. They're still young adults at the end of the day. Yeah.
I mean, it could happen. I mean, we still talk about Frankie Morbidelli doing silly things in MotoGP, so he's not alone. But it was just more so that coincidence of how we were praising the maturity, the effort, and the change of David Muñoz. And immediately, the second I'm watching practice, I'm going, oh, David, no, no. And I knew it was coming. There was bound to be a penalty coming his way, and I thought, oh, God, it's like, yeah, it's happened. But you might be right. Maybe this is like a rite of passage where riders just have to take it. Rueda did it. He came from the back of the grid. Alonso was never in that conversation, but he did it from the back of the grid. And same as Brad Binder. Jerez 2016.
Binder did it. Marquez did it. And Marquez did it because he was a very naughty boy in his younger years.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. All the way up to Moto 2, he was a little bugger, Marquez. And I think maybe a lot of the fans don't realise this who are watching as of recently. But Marquez is not the nice, smooth rider he always has been. I think we're seeing an evolution, which I'll get to later. But he's definitely was an aggressive little bugger back in the days. I think Paul Espargaro sent to the moon no end of times.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Mark didn't make any qualms about not being friends with anyone on the track. He's you know, didn't end careers, but he definitely made a good go of it. I mean, even his 125 days, I think he crashed on the warm-up lap and started from pit lane, still won.
Was that Estoril?
And in, I think it was, yeah. And then, yeah, in his Moto 2 days, he got sent to the back of the grid for riding into someone. Or I can't remember the exact reason, but I think it might have been in Phillip Island.
It was awesome to watch, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and a large part of that was he was so aggressive on the opening lap that he did half of the work in the first lap.
Maybe that's a Moto2 thing, because Johann Zarco had the same thing when he came up to MotoGP. But we'll get to Moto2 in a moment. But yeah, back to Moto3 just briefly. I don't know if you've seen some memes and the conversations about Dennis Foggia being in Moto3 as like the old veteran of Moto3. I saw a few as I looked before even starting this podcast tonight. But couldn't help to notice Dennis Foggia and Max Quiles not working in tandem to help catch up to Jose Antonio Rueda. And it's not a problem if those who didn't see this, but it's more a question of Moto3 and the mentality. When the rider gets to the front, everyone wants to be that rider to catch them. Everyone believes that I'll tap the back of my seat and you guys will follow me because I'm quicker. And it just never, ever works. Do you think we'll ever see it work? Will any riders form an alliance on the track to say, you know what, we can catch him, but we've got to stay together.
The thing is what do they call it? Red mist sets in. And you could have a prearranged plan before you went out, between your teammate or between your best mate. And as soon as the first lap gets underway and they pass you, you're like, no, I was leading the first lap, not you. That wasn't the agreement. And yeah, then that's it. Off you go, red mist sets in. He's a so-and-so and this and that. And yeah, plans fly out the window. But a lot of it as well is that... they believe they have the pace, but the reason for being in front is to run their lines. And if they have someone in front who's, let's say, breaks a bit later and uses their weight to get out of the corner better versus someone who breaks earlier and releases the brake and runs a corner speed, it's those sort of differences that can really hinder you in trying to catch up. And I don't think it's anything to do with... you know, being the rider who caught the leader. It's more so just believing in yourself that you can. You know, you see the gap and you think, hang on, let's not fight now. I'll deal with you on the last lap happily, but the guy in front's getting away, so stop your nonsense, let's crack on with it.
But I think, as you say, every single rider on that grid feels like they're the best rider in the world. They feel like they're yeah. You follow me. I don't need to follow you. You're going to hold me up. I'll do it. And then they think the same. But I've watched Moto3 every single day, every single time it's on, every single, for the past few years. And David Alonso would just go, see ya. And now they're letting Rueda to do it, and they're all infighting. And you just think, why not be him? Why not just do that same plan? It's baffling, but it's so entertaining to watch.
Yeah, and it's very rare that you get someone who's capable of doing that. I think Danny Kent was one of the more infamous ones.
Yeah.
For he would just go out, do his own laps, didn't need a tow, and was rapid on his own. So he knew come the race that he could pull the gap if he needed to. And it only works in your favor as that rider if the rest squabble behind you.
I think looking back over the years, you got to pinpoint the name, bang on, absolutely perfect, Danny Kent. Brad Binder could do it as well, but he's a battler. He likes a good battle. Juan Mir was pretty nippy in that regard. 2017, I think he was a champion. And Ethan Guevara. Oh,
yeah.
Mega at doing that. Absolutely brilliant. I thought Ethan Guevara's Moto3 championship season was one of the more boring ones because of him and how good he was at escaping the pack. Yeah. I think the last one would be Lorenzo Dalla Porta. He was a rocket ship on that Leopard Honda. He was a bloody rocket.
Yeah, he made that Leopard Honda the team to be with. He made it look like this is... Because every other rider will look at it and go, well, it's not him, it must be the bike. Like, I could do that if I had his bike.
Well, yeah. I think even I could sit here and say that at home whilst I'm watching. No, I can't do
it. I think even Neil Hodgson caught himself out this weekend by watching Mark. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, he was basically trying to say Mark makes it look so easy, but just ended up saying that, I could do that.
And everyone's like, no, thank you. So let's just quickly move on to Moto2 then, mate. What did you think about the Moto2 race? Now, first and foremost, obviously not the most encapsulating race in the sense of overtakes, battles, collisions, anything like that. It was very much a strategic return to Brno race. And what a performance from Joe Roberts. Now, I did say I didn't expect to see Joe Roberts anywhere near the podium or wins this season. Podium, actually, no, that's a lie. Podium is fine. But the win is the difficult bit with the level of competition. But when you look back at Joe Roberts' performance in the Czech Republic, he debuted in 2017, 10th place, retired the next race, or didn't start, can't remember, but then he had a podium there for the last time he raced. So clearly, he goes well in Brno. And Pecco Bagnaia made a reference to it being a Czech Mugello in certain areas. And you know who also does well at Mugello? Joe Roberts. So maybe this should have been on the cards, and maybe I have mislooked this, or you know, just completely missed this completely. What do you reckon? Did you see Joe Roberts up there?
It makes sense. I didn't see it happening because, like you, I didn't realize that, you know, this had been his form track. It doesn't surprise me though that, you know, he has that level within him. He didn't do himself any favors this year. In the beginning of the year, he'd been injured. And he had the confidence coming in as well. I'm pretty sure I saw an interview with him saying, I've got what it takes to beat everyone else on that grid, or something along those lines. And yeah, it just was never there to begin with. And with the injury, didn't help. And, you know, I think we're also talking about at certain times, the top 20 have been covered by a second. You know, that's nothing, next to nothing, where you could go out and find two tenths and move up no positions. It's an incredibly tight field this year. So all credit to Joe. And maybe this is the confidence. You know, sometimes you just need a victory on a track that you know well and you go well, and it boosts you to go forward. I wouldn't say he's out of the championship, but it's very hard for him to make the recovery from here.
I think speaking of confidence, Joe Roberts has always been a very confident person, confident rider. He believes in himself, and he sure he should. He's a Moto 2 rider, for goodness sake. He's an excellent rider. He's a 3-time winner now, if I'm not mistaken. But speaking of confidence, well, I think we go from one end to the spectrum and to the other. Now, Jake Dixon, after the Sachsenring Grand Prix, didn't do him any favours. This was actually, I'm going to quote you here when you text me. Didn't do him any favours in that interview last week in the Sachsenring. This weekend, he's kind of backed it up again. You know, he still really feels that he is the best in the world, which I love, because you have to believe that. I remember when Aleix Espargaró said he feels he's the best rider in the world, and everyone laughed.
Yeah.
You have to believe that, otherwise you'll never progress.
I had an argument with someone about that. I think it was a journalist somewhere, and said, to take the piss out of Aleix Espargaró for thinking that is one thing, but have you even considered that you need that mentality? Whether you are or not is a different story, but if you don't believe you can win, then why are you even there?
Yeah.
You know, what are you there just to get points, just to get a few Instagram posts and a couple of likes? Like, you're there to win, and you have to believe you can win to begin that process. So, yeah, and look, Jake needs that mentality, as every other rider does. Where he does himself no favors is... and maybe it's the journalist, and now the reality is the journalists know that in the heat of the moment, he's not going to think twice about what to say. He's going to give it straight from the heart. And yeah, it comes off in the wrong way. And this is the difference between him and Pedro. Pedro can be angry, and you can see he's physically angry, but he'll rein it in and say something else. And that's not a knock on Jake. It's not a knock on anyone, but it's perhaps the reason why he falls on the fence, you know, with people that like him or dislike him. Not that that should matter to him, but yeah.
Yeah, because the reason why I brought it up, because I saw a post earlier, I think it probably was a TNT, and I think you're absolutely bang on. I still often think about the moment when him and Darren Binder collided in the British GP at Silverstone. The immediate time to go and stick a microphone in his face, the absolute worst time in the world for anyone to speak to about someone when you're at your home Grand Prix, you've had a crash, a collision. You know, he said some very abrupt things about Darren Binder and about everything in general. And I think we, you know, being from, you know, TNT being a English thing or a British thing where we're trying to build our British riders, that's the worst thing we could do, is put them in a situation where you can make them look foolish. So, I do believe Jake Dixon is still a championship contender, but the way he carries off is if he's already winning it, or he's 5 points behind. He's still a contender simply because of how competitive Moto 2 is, and you can't really contend anyone out when there's still 10 rounds to go.
Coming into this season and last season, he was kind of one of the favourites, maybe not the favourite, but definitely one of the favourites.
Yeah,
had,
I'd agree with
had
that.
The experience, had the, you know, the talent on display at multiple times. And for whatever reason, last year I think they made the switch to white power suspension and it didn't work out for them. And then this year I believe he may have even switched chassis manufacturer. I'm not 100%. Eventually you get to the end of your time in MotoGP and you have to have said, like, I tried everything. You know, you either tried everything or you have a reason as to why you didn't win. For me, I'd rather go to bed knowing I tried everything and put it all on display rather than say, well, you know, I was going to win that race, but someone rode into me or they slowed me down in qualifying. I didn't have a good grid. A rider will always have an excuse, and it seems like Jake is that rider who, no matter what happens, will have an excuse. And then when he wins, it's because he won. You know, it's got nothing to do with the team working over the weekend.
So I do like Jake, to be fair. I love his mentality. I like him as a person. I think he does. I think he does give credit where credit is due, but he is very in the moment. I think he absolutely loves the people he's around. I think he cares deeply about them all. But I think in the heat of the moment, he's just a deer in the headlights. You know, he has that sort of like excitement about him. But then when the negative comes, he's really negative. You know, it's that even keel, something that I think we all have difficulty with, not trying to get too high on the positives and too low on the negatives. But the big thing about it is, though, is that all them championship contenders, all those riders in that grid, what would put him any higher than someone, say, Barry Baltus, who's only currently 54 points in the championship now? Barry Baltus is not giving you the big one. He's not talking like he's the world champion. He's very respectful, very polite, and very, very self-aware. So would you say that Barry Baltus would be stronger if he had Jake Dixon's personality, or would he be worse? Or,
you know, there's one question that comes about where that would be suitable, is like, who's your perfect, how would you build your perfect motorcycle racer? And, you know, you say Binder's aggression, Marquez's IQ, Rossi's charisma, Lorenzo's smoothness, Stoner's ability to just ride a bike on the rabbit edge, Pedrosa's ability to pick the bike up super quick. You can say that, and I'm sure there is a case where that works for Baltus and Dixon, and they fall into those little brackets. But at the end of the day, they are who they are, and there's things that they can work on, and there's things that don't need to be worked on because it's got them to where they are right now.
That's a very good answer, actually. That's a good point. Now I'm thinking, let's do the perfect ride at some point. I'm going to make it down. I'll tell you what, I'll do this. We'll get the viewers involved as well, and we'll try and design our own perfect rider. But we will have to have some parameters, because you can't just have Rossi everything and Marquez everything, because that's just not fair.
The thing is, the reality is, Mark's learned things from Pedrosa, from Stoner, from Rossi, and adapted them. Martin's changed the game with his riding style in terms of how much he's off the bike. There are so many things now that have moved on that you'd be silly to say, you know, split Rossi and Mark in half and just put them together, that's the perfect rider. It's very much not anymore.
But back to Barry Baltus, because I don't think anyone's giving him enough credit for what he's doing right now in the season. Currently 54 points behind Manu Gonzalez, who was predictable he would do well, and just 29 points behind teammate Aaron Canet. Now, Barry Baltus has just slowly and quietly gone about his business. Excellently executed for the season. I'm generally thinking the Manuel Gonzalez has made a few mistakes, Aaron Canet's made a few mistakes. We could be looking at a surprise winner here that would possibly stay within the paddock. Now, there's not been, nobody stayed after winning the World Championship since Johann Zarco and Tito Rabat. So, is there a thing here, or is it going to fizzle out and my dreams and aspirations just crumble to dust?
Potentially, yeah. And there's a side to that question that reared its ugly head again this weekend. Manu Gonzalez does not like the rain at all. It's like his kryptonite, his Achilles heel. And it's crazy how much it affects him, how far off the pace he is. And if we have more wet races, he's not guaranteed the championship. In the dry, he's undeniably good. And then you have Canet, who's prone to mistakes here and there. And I think Baltus is in the perfect position of everyone. He's the underdog. He has no real kind of pressure, no expectation. Obviously, no one's expecting him to be last, being Canet's teammate. He's on a good bike. He's with a good team. But no one's expecting him to be where he is, apart from Barry and maybe his team. But no, it's awesome. And how good is it to have Belgium up there? When was the last
fantastic
Belgium we had up front?
Xavier Simeon?
Probably. Yeah. Don't let Sergio hear you say that name.
I was waiting for that. Sergio, if you're listening, sorry, mate. But no, Baza, though, you know, he could have won the Saxon Ring. I know we spoke about this earlier, coulda, woulda, shoulda, and if what's buts and maybes, but he could have won. You know, there was a definite chance he was building up to fight for the victory. And then we start looking at the likes of Dennis Onchu, building momentum, winning races, Yoga Marrera after, obviously, this weekend, and get back to form again, regroup. You might be right, you know, if we do get more rain, it's very much like Lorenzo was, you know, Lorenzo impervious in the wet, in the dry, but next year a bit of rain comes and he's sitting in the pits looking disappointed.
Yeah, it doesn't always work out. And I mean, like, look, we're not saying that he's completely incapable, and neither was Lorenzo. It just was that they were not on the same level as the others in the wet. And it's a strange one, because Lorenzo's way of riding was exactly what you need in the wet. Is the most bizarre thing that it didn't translate. And I've not seen enough of Gonzalez or spoken to enough people to understand his way of riding, but I'm pretty sure it's the same. Very smooth, not aggressive, a lot of corner speed, and yeah, just doesn't seem to work in the wet for whatever reason.
Hopefully he sorts it out, but at the same time, kind of hope not, because he might run away from it. So I'm hoping we do see a bit of a battle, but there's nothing confirmed yet for both Canet or Gonzalez about a move for the 2026 season. A lot of rumours about Aaron Canet going to World Superbike, Jake Dixon to World Superbike. Who knows at this point? I think it's just a guessing game. But preference from me today, and always will be, please can we have a defending champion in Moto2? I think having a defending champion in the classes is always more interesting from a fan's perspective than having them just disappear straight up. I know it makes sense, but I would like to see it, so a bit of a selfish sight from me. But moving on to MotoGP, Marquez, again, I guess we're going to do this again. We're going to just sing his praises for another week in a row. Superb. Yeah. Sublime. I think we're running out of superlatives. I'm running out of post ideas on the graphics. It's just Marquez done it again. The 93 is dominating my MotoGP winners board on the Knee Down Instagram page. He's dominating. What can be said about Marquez's performance again this weekend? Or are we a little bit too praise friendly when looking at the gap was only around 1.5 seconds ahead of Marco Bezzecchi? Craig, take the floor.
I still of the opinion that Mark is on another level, and that result was the way he wanted it to be. 1.5 seconds, half a second, 25 seconds, you still win the race at the end of the day. And what blew my mind was his overtake on Betts. He had the foresight to understand that in making that overtake, he allowed Bez to cut back. And not only would Bez then cut back, he would be on his outside. Mark knew exactly where to position himself to just completely close it all off, and then disappeared. Fastest lap, fastest lap, fastest lap. Just how do you catch someone when you can't go faster than them, or they can just pull out 0.2 seconds whenever they feel like it? It's him on this Ducati. And there was an interesting point to tie back to Neil Hodgson, that when he rode the Honda, it was on the limit everywhere, and you were like, how do you get away with it? I can't honestly say I've seen him on the limit once this year. And is that because the Ducati is exceptional, or is that just because the two of them together are probably the greatest package you've seen in a long time?
The interesting part about this is I actually had the same conversation with my mum yesterday. Now, my mum actually was the one who got me into MotoGP, so it's not just like me talking randomly to my mother, but my mum's also a big MotoGP fan, and we actually had a discussion about this in depth, and it was quite an interesting one that lasted like an hour, because we were so in keen about this conversation. Now, we came up with a theory, and I'm thinking a lot about Marquez and how he's riding that. Look at that 2019 lap time where he took pole in the mixed conditions. That looked rapid and ridiculously risky. But a lot of his races looked like that, whether it was mixed conditions or not. He just had that feeling on the RC213V where he could just launch it anywhere he wanted to. But every single time it was on that limit. Now, let's move forward to Ducati, the evolution of Marquez in 2025. He's that same rider 2019, but evolved. So perhaps all those years of that Honda trying to bite and trying to kick him off and trying to just kick around, maybe the Ducati does that, but so minimal that he can just use it to its strengths. So, like Banyaya, for example, Digia, maybe they're having those moments and going, whoa, I don't like that. And Marquez is going, that's nothing. You want to try the Honda, mate. And he's able to just ride it as he wants. So, like you saw in Brno, even in Sachsenring, there's a few corners that catch him off guard ever slightly. But it's never enough to go, oh, he's going to crash. He's out of control. He's losing it. And he's somehow turned into that Lorenzo-esque metronomic style that I thought Pecco Bagnaia was closest to. And now, as you say, I think you hit the nail perfectly on the head there. He beat Marco Bezzecchi and everyone else by 1.8 seconds or 2 seconds because that's all he needed to do. And I do wonder if we're actually seeing a rider that is just doing what needs to be done now. Because, you know, he doesn't look like he's battled a 250-horsepower machine. He just looks like he's finished and he's ready to dance because he's won another race. I'm surprised. It's so effortless for Marc Marquez at the moment. And do you think there could be a sense of that Honda data, knowing that the bike was trying to kill him, to a bike that says, jump on, or jump on in, the water's lovely? What do you think? Is there anything to that?
It confuses me is how much faster could he go? Because I think for sure we saw, and that would have been one of the, probably the greatest laps in recent history, if he'd have completed that qualifying lap and did the 151. That, I think, is the closest we've come to seeing him on the limit, where he had to dig deep. Mm. I mean, he had experience in Brno, but the GP25 had no experience. The GP24 had no experience. The GP23 had no experience. The modern evolution of that Ducati has no data from Brno. So, yeah, hands were behind the backs and trying to invent something out of nothing to do the 51. I don't think he would have thought that was possible, but he gave it a good go, and unfortunately, it, you know, bit him. And that was kind of old Honda Marquez resurfacing. But then come race day, no problem. Come the sprint, oh yeah, my tire pressure's out. Let me just pull in behind Pedro and then overtake him. And yeah, I'm gone again. I won the sprint. And then GP race, oh, Bez is in front. Yeah, no worries. Okay, I'm done. See you guys later. And gone. Like, just unbelievable. And like I said to you, you know, the reality is we don't get that understanding of just how dominant he's been until you see, like, your knee down post of the winners. It's just a sea of 93s, you know. When I was talking to you about it, the, you know, if you took Mark's sprint wins, sprint points away from him, he'd still be second in the championship. If you took his main points away from him, he'd still be fourth in the championship. It's unbelievable. This is, I think, if it carries on, going to eclipse the year where he, what was it, he finished, like, every race he finished was no lower than second. Yeah, I think it's going to eclipse that season, just in terms of the dominance.
I think he may very well beat his 2014 record of wins in a season, which I think was 13 wins. He's on 8 now. I think I wrote it down somewhere. I think he's on 8 Grand Prix wins, 11 sprint wins. 11 sprint wins is absolutely ridiculous. Just, is there anyone who's going to get close to him? You know, I think a lot of people say, oh, well, Pecco Bagnaia, he's not as good as teammate. Pecco Bagnaia, it's in his head. Marquez, in that situation, it's in everyone's head. No one's beating him. Why are we putting the pressure on Pecco? Like, you know,
he
can't beat him either. He's got, his bike is clearly not working for him. He's trying everything he can. It's just not working well. And this is why I was saying earlier with Marquez that maybe he is having those moments that Pecco was having where the front doesn't feel like there's anything there. But he's ridden a Honda that was the, you know, from 24, 23, well, 23, 22 and 21 when he was riding there injured, it was a lethal machine. Joan Mir crashed no end of times. Honda crashed 52 times in the entire season. It was a mess. To this, to now, you've been through the hardship, you've got the best bike, you're the best rider in the world. Makes sense, doesn't it? It really does make perfect sense that we are seeing the cohesion of two superpowers, two megapowers in MotoGP. But the question is will it ever change?
No, exactly. And there's an interesting, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Would Mark be the rider he is now without those Honda years? Or with that Honda being as evil as it was towards the end of his career.
But for Marc Marquez on the Ducati, now, this weekend was a bit of a strange one because, but you've sort of touched base upon it. Ducati GP Evolution has got no data. The last time they had it was a GP19 and GP20. GP19 was on the pole position and the podium. But Ducati didn't do well in 2020. It was Johann Zarco. And they didn't particularly do well here. Digi Antonio was nowhere to be seen. Morbidelli was injured. Aldeguer was just getting better, but of course he's still learning. It's a rookie season, so yeah. let him off. Alex Marquez was dreadful in the racing sprint. To see him from the start of the season to so good, the win in Jerez, consistent in sprints, to just, Alex Marquez looks like a rookie again. Are we seeing Ducati's dominance shrink?
I think another part of that as well is there's two Ducatis missing this year. So, you know, from before you had eight of them, and, you know, eight of them could fill the top 10 quite easily. Whereas now there's six of them. Aldeguer's a rookie, and I'm pretty sure I'm right in this, but please, if I'm not, prove me wrong. Aldeguer has never seen Bruno before because he came straight into Moto 2. I think he did 2 years in Moto 2 and then jumped up to Moto GP.
It could be, yeah, because Aldeguer came to Moto 2, what, 22, 23, 24? Yeah. Yeah, right, because I did the video. So, yeah, he never did.
Yeah, so not only was it his first time on a GP bike, it was his first time at the track.
Zero experience then, yeah, good point.
Yeah, so he didn't do too bad. He came all right in the main race. Alex, I got a funny feeling that it could be two parts, or maybe both played a little bit into each other. A lot of what we've heard is that whatever Mark runs on his bike, Alex bolts onto his and just makes it work as best he can. There was no data this time. There was none of that this time. And the constant rain in practice didn't help him with the dry either. The other part is when you have an injury like he did, like his hand injury, and he went in, had surgery, came back, got pumped full of painkillers, adrenaline dump, did amazing in Sachsenring, all things considered. Then your body gets used to it. Your mind gets used to it. So come the next time, you still have that, but it starts to hurt a little bit more. It starts going over that kind of adrenaline ability to get over it. So maybe it's a little bit of that. And it just didn't seem to be anywhere all weekend. And then I'm not on the fence with the Joan Mir incident, because I think that he didn't necessarily go for an overtake, but he went for a gap that was there. And then pulled the front brake when he saw that gap closing, and that's why he crashed. I don't think it was like a lunge of the ages, impatient to overtake him. And then it's just unfortunate how that happens. And I heard that those two had at least a 5 minute conversation on the surface road about what. I'd love to have been a fly on the wall for that.
Yeah, I'd love to know what they said. I saw the video and I've seen some memes on it too, but unfortunately I have no idea what they said. But apparently apologies have been accepted. Joan Mir thinks no less of Alex Marquez, which is a good thing. Joan Mir is a good guy. He just got took out. It's unfortunate. Alex said he wanted to go for just a try to see if it was possible, and then, as you say, just close the front because I'm not going to be able to. I'm gone. It's easy done. Yeah. But I think it's more of a testament to Alex Marquez's performance this season why I can say this is a bad weekend for Alex. He's done so well this season that to even consider this as a bad weekend is, you know, it's praise to Alex Marquez. But it was a bad weekend from any standard, even if it was last season.
Because, I mean, let's not forget, he's second in the championship, and up until this point was like 60 points ahead of Pecco. I mean, absurd. And it's funny how one race meeting can change. You know, it wasn't so long ago everyone was complaining that he's playing bodyguard to his brother, and now it's he has had a bad weekend, what's gone wrong?
But the fact of the championship standings has changed, just as you mentioned there. It's no longer a massive gap. It's now a massive gap the other way. It's Marquez now trail 100 points now. I think we've eclipsed at this point. Yeah. He's ahead of Alex Marquez, but big move up, because we were talking about this battle from last time. The Italian battle for fourth. Now, Marco Bezzecchi is holding on to that one quite firmly now, after a very solid P2 in the sprint, into the Bruno GP. Now, yeah. I thought Bezzecchi had a bit of something this weekend for Marquez, after seeing how well he started and how he was trying to do just to try and hold off Mark. But even he, you know, he came to the conclusion where he felt that he wasn't going to beat Mark, but it was just try exactly what he could do. Try and break away, try and save a bit here and there, and then when Mark comes, just do your best. And as you say, outsmarted with the experience and IQ of Marquez to go into turn three aggressive, which I think he tapped four or five riders he overtook this weekend into turn three, Marquez this is, and then blocks him off in turn four, can't get the right-hander, he's already through. But give full credit to Marco Bezzecchi. He is my favourite rider, so I'm going to be a little bit biased. I am chuffed to mint balls to see Marco Bezzecchi doing really well. I'm really pleased. I think he's one of the most underrated riders on the grid. Never won that championship in either Moto3 or Moto2, but always there. Always the runner-up or close enough to, and deserves a lot of credit for what he's done this weekend. And with Aprilia in general.
Yeah, no, and this is the thing, is, again, to my point last year, we had eight Ducatis. And so you would see three, four, sometimes even five in the top five. And Aprilia were the ones who could occasionally come in. So let's take Mark out of the equation, because I don't think anyone at this point in time has anything for it. Bez is the next one. You would have expected Pecco to be there, or Alex, or Digi, or Frankie, but it was Bez. You know, eclipsing all of the others. And maybe in that sense, yeah, the others have caught up to Ducati. Or maybe it's just that the Ducatis haven't got going as of yet. But yeah, there was Bez. And it just seems to be building on momentum. And talking of Aprilia, and on the other side of the garage, Martin with a fantastic comeback, considering how long he's been out, the injuries that he's had, the drama that's gone on, and the team looked genuinely chuffed for him, regardless of where he finished, how he did. Every session was an achievement for the team, which was so nice to see. Because it didn't have to be. You know, they could have cold-shouldered him, but they won him there, ultimately, and they won him happy. I did see one of the most incredible statistics, and I have to credit Now Moto News for this. Jorge Martin now officially cannot win the World Championship, such as Mark's point advantage. The remaining points is one less than Bagnaia would need. So if Mark and everyone else stopped racing, Martin still couldn't win the championship. And that just goes to show how long he's been out, how much ground he's lost this year.
And all that struggles, the conversation. His manager clearly hasn't done him any favours in a lot of things. It's been a very, very tough year for Jorge Martin, and it's far from what we anticipated. But I'd say, just as it is impactful to Martin, it's been just as impactful to Aprilia as well, because I don't think they expected such a topsy-turvy season, a topsy-turvy start, a concerning start, looking for new riders. I'm pretty certain last season when they signed Marco Bezzecchi and Jorge Martin, they thought, we're sorted. For the next few years, we'll be well up there fighting. But I think it's still exposed that the Aprilia is not as good as the Ducati yet. And where I'm seeing it is a lot of corner exits. They can't compete. Marquez blasts out the corners. But I think Bez is doing something like what Marquez was doing last year on the GP23, where he looks like, oh, well, he's not catching because he's not got the speed or the skill. No, I think it's bike dependent. The Aprilia needs a little bit more. But they're there and thereabout. Whether that the gap to Ducati will shrink or whether Ducati will start to struggle, who knows? But I think they're close, but they're still not there yet. So I think what Bez is doing is absolutely superb. I think it is, at the minute, a little bit more rider than bike at this point. And I think Martina made that difference too, coming in, finishing P7, which is, as you say, terrific. Straight directly through to Q2 from practice in the wet. Awesome. That's when the nerves come in the most, thinking that you're going to crash. Sublime. Absolutely brilliant performance from Jorge Martin.
Yeah, no. Top. And I mean, that's why he's a world champion. You know, that kind of a ride is what says it. In that same regard, I would have said Luca Marini is more of a world champion. Just because I think, you know, He went away, he did Honda a favour or the other way around in testing for Suzuka, and really lucky to get out of that and still be able to ride and bounce back, wanted to be back as soon as he could, wanted to be riding as soon as he could. And for all intents and purposes, I don't know how many people have joked about Juan Mir trying to get out of that Honda contract because it's such an awful place to be. You would not think Marini would be rushing back so soon to get back on a bike, deliver in Sachsenring, and again, did superb in Brno, all things considered.
Luke Marini finished 12th, still battered and bruised, a bloody good performance.
And that's kind of where Yamaha and Honda are at the moment, is I think they're realistic in terms of they're not going to be pushing for wins. They're just pushing to close that gap to the winner. And that's the steps that they have to make. I'd be really interested to see how far off the Honda was last year in a race similar to Brno.
It is night and day difference for Honda to think that we even see them in a race. That's a big telling sign. When did we see them last season? I think we saw Joan Mir get punted by Marquez in Jerez, and maybe when there was a crash graphic. I know that sounds awful. There's a bike going past my house there. But it's true. We didn't see the Hondas unless something they crashed or something bad happened.
Yet we're seeing them
in good light. Joan Mir qualified 5th.
Joan Mir was on for a really strong weekend. That was just so unfortunate. And I heard that the HRC team posted, you know, Joan Mir's taken out, he's out of the race. And about 4 hours later, his flight got cancelled.
Oh, I saw that.
He needs to go see a shaman or a witch doctor or just be blessed with some sage and earth crystals or something. Like, something has to change.
It's madness, isn't it? I saw a comment to that one. It just says, how did this guy win the 2020 World Championship? And you think, well, that's 5 years ago. That's completely different to the look he's having right now. And he was the best rider in 2020. If anyone who watched that season, he was by far the most consistent, strongest rider. But random topic, just to add to this, I think a lot of people don't remember the fact that Joan Mir also finished 3rd the year after. So it wasn't the flash in the pan like people make out to be. Joan Mir is still very talented, but he is on a very difficult bike to ride. And he's very determined to make it work. And I think a lot of riders would have walked by now.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the one thing you cannot take away from him is he is a trier. He, regardless of how bad a bike is to ride or how much people are telling him not to ride, he will be the determining factor. And if he throws his leg over the bike, you can guarantee he's given 100%.
And as you say, that fifth place in qualifying does not come out of just luck or random. He worked his arse off for that, and he's doing so well. It was when I saw Alex hit him, the camera just panned away, and he knew that Joanne had crashed because of the nature of the horsepower hill corner. He wasn't going to save that. And I just thought, not again. But in Joanne Mir's opinion, he feels it's because the bike is 10 kilometres slower. So that's why he's putting himself in those situations, because he can't get out of trouble. And I think maybe there's some truth to that, because he can't get hit every single race. But Luca Marini hasn't crashed, and he's still not been hit. I don't know.
Yeah, and this is the thing, you know. I don't for 1 minute think that Luca Marini isn't trying hard. I just think that his approach is a little bit different. I think Mir's seeing, how do I ride around this problem? And Marini seeing it as, how do I ride with this problem?
A bit like Zarco's.
And so, yeah, exactly. How do I make the best out of what I have instead of how do I make up for the shortcomings, you know?
Because it must be tough, especially surrounded by, you know, Italian bikes like the Ducatis and the Aprilias. Even the KTMs, you know, they leave them for dust as well when they get them to the power. It must be bloody damn near impossible. But,
yeah,
gotta give them credit where we can. But getting back to just briefly about the MotoGP race. Now, we talked about Raul Fernandez, we talked about Jorge Martin and Pedro Acosta, but I think what we got to give a little bit more credit and praise to is Enea Bastianini. Now, it was rumoured, apparently it was never true, that he had appendicitis last week. Apparently, he had food poisoning and lost a good couple of kilograms in weight because he was so
three
ill.
3 kilos.
Oh, yeah. That's a lot.
That is a lot, and you also have to think they are peak condition athletes. They don't have 3 kilos to lose. Otherwise, they would have lost it already, you know? So, yeah, it was pretty bad by the sounds of it. And, fair enough, didn't ride, came back this weekend. Maybe he flushed out the bad juju or whatever was holding him back. You know, get your tinfoil hat for that one.
he said everything that came out was green.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. It's gone. the jealousy of not being on a Ducati anymore has left the building.
I really, really hope this is a change. Now, I did a post on Twitter about this for the Needown channel, and I was asking the question, you know, is Pedro Costa, is this the turning point for him? Is this the turning point for Andrea Bastianini? I really hope it is. But I'm not convinced yet. I do think you were right. Bruno at KTM goes well, but Austria, back garden, what do you reckon?
KTM goes well as well. I don't think we'll see quite the same as what Bruno is, but I think at least one or two of them will challenge. Top five, maybe. I think Pecco, Mark will be the ones to catch. Mark, for sure, is going to be the one to catch. It's not a track he's done well at, and more so because a Ducati has beaten him.
Yes.
comes to mind.
I did a video on this a while ago about tracks that Marquez hasn't won at, and one of them has been circled in red 100% is the circuit of Austria. As you say, denied by Dovi three times, twice at very least, denied by Lorenzo on a Ducati, and just never won there. You better believe that this is the year where Marquez ticks that off and puts it on his resume to say, I was a winner at the Austrian Grand Prix.
I think a point is going to be proved in 3 weeks' time in Austria. I don't really see the Yamahas or the Hondas being there in terms of in the, you know, the fight for the top five. Maybe Fabio pulls out a strong qualifying lap. I think KTM could be the best of the rest in terms of challenging the Ducatis in Austria.
Certainly hope so. But a bit of rain. You know, it's a bit dodgy there sometimes. You look at 2021 when Brad Binder won.
Oh, yeah.
We could be seeing a little bit of a surprise over there in the Red Bull Ring of Austria. Maybe it would be nice to see that, change up a bit.
Yeah, exactly. And it always makes it more entertaining. I mean, you cannot tell me that Brad's heroics will ever be forgotten. Not because of who he is or my bias, but just the nature of how that race unfolded and what he did was crazy.
So I'm going to quickly move on now to our next point, actually. Two things, actually. First and foremost, matte fact for the viewers listening or watching. It's not quite a matte fact. It's a Craig fact, but Craig fact supplied matte fact. Matte fact, Knee Down podcast. You get it. Now, Craig told me there was only 12 riders on the current MotoGP grid that actually rode at Brno beforehand.
Just for clarity's purpose, ridden a MotoGP bike.
So it has to be a proper MotoGP bike, not a Moto2 or anything, or any other prototype machine from Brno. Okay then, matte fact it is then. So the 12 riders are Mark and Alex Marquez, both have ridden there in Brno on a MotoGP bike, Pecco Bagnaia, Frankie Morbidelli, Maverick Vinales, Brad Binder, Jack Miller, Alex Rins, Fabio Quartararo, Joan Mir, Miguel Oliveira, and Joan Zarco. Now, I think there would be a great point there when you said earlier, the rider that hasn't even ridden in Brno, and it could very well be Fermin Aldeguer.
Yeah.
That's, I still baffled by that, and I think I will look into this, but I think you're right, because I'm pretty certain he came to the championship in 2022.
Yeah.
In for a recovery ride in Mugello. It was either 2021 or 22, but it definitely wasn't 2020.
No, exactly. And he came through the Junior GP ranks, so that at the time had just been converted from the Spanish CEV, so they didn't go to Brno.
Yeah, FIM-CEV.
Yeah, so it would have been majority Spanish tracks that he'd ridden on up until that point. I'm sure he's been there on a track day or something just to get an idea of the track, but yeah, he's never raced there before, as far as I'm aware.
But the crazy thing is, to follow up on what we were saying, is the likes of Marco Bezzecchi finished second, never been there before on a MotoGP bike, and neither did Pedro Costa. And yet two of them finished on the podium. So, how? I mean, wouldn't that extra all the experience benefit? Or is it just a case of, as you say, the new bikes, this with the new evolution, with the ride-out device, electronics? It's a different situation. In fact, speaking of electronics, we never actually mentioned Pecco Bagnaia turning off the traction control to go faster here in Brno.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on that? Is that a norm now? Should riders try this?
It's an option within, I don't know if you've seen the left-hander, we spoke about it with Alex last week, how many buttons they have. And two of those buttons is like a plus and a minus. and it will, you can manually change your traction control, maybe not on the MotoGP bikes, but you can also have a map which has traction control 3 or traction control 0. So instead of fiddling around, you just press your button and it's, you know, map 1, map 2, whatever. It's not unheard of. The issue is you have to really be in tune with your bike to manage a race distance with no traction, because obviously you're controlling how much spin you have, and that will just not really prolong the life of your tire, if anything, decrease it. So, yeah, I mean, over one lap, I can see it working. I can see it being a benefit, especially if you're very good with control. And we know Pecco rides with Rossi. He's used to sliding the bike. He's used to having that kind of feeling, that control at the ranch. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me as such. I'd be surprised if he did it in the race, for the whole race, because I just don't think it is beneficial.
I think he referred to just the last part, where it's the usual Pecco. It's the start well, struggle, get a bit more fire, struggle, and then a little bit more towards the end. And I think it was towards the end where he said he felt he had to turn it off. So, yeah, it was something I wanted to just bring up there, because it's baffled me to think that. I wonder how many other riders are doing that too. I wonder if anyone is changing that with like a profile button.
It's all dependent on what the tire wear is like over the weekend. You know, if you feel somewhere like Aragon, which is a really rough and abrasive surface, it can work and it doesn't work in the same sense. Like, you're going to have spin, and then you're at the point where traction control is working, and is it working with you or against you? If it starts working against you because the race goes on and you're getting a lot more spin, but you feel like you've still got the tire to manage, then you turn the traction control off so it doesn't cut in and work against you. It
I'd
is
like
very
to know
much
how many
a,
you do it.
A rider aid, and sometimes it doesn't always help. There are specific scenarios, let's say.
I would really like to know. I think there's another few things, like how many riders, you know, how they use the rear brake and things, because obviously every single rider is different. Even some riders use the thumb brake, of course. So it'd be really curious to see how that works and how every single rider sort of deals with that. But I guess we'll get on to our next segment then, before we almost finish up, Craig. And I guess kind of touched base upon it already, but the title implications of Brno. Now, Marquez leads by 100 points, and Pecco, Alex Marquez do not seem to be anywhere near Mark's level. It shouldn't be, but it looks like a foregone conclusion. Do you think we are going to see any difference now, or is it just simply a case of this is the Marquez year, and this is put down in history as one of the biggest comebacks in sporting history?
Oh, for sure it would. And, you know, touch wood, I hope nothing happens to anyone. It would take something along those lines for it to become, you know, a challenge. Because the reality is, Mark doesn't have to win every race here on out. He can finish second, he can finish third. Because Alex and Pecco aren't going to win every race from here on out. For a start, there's two of them fighting for one position. So it is kind of like a perfect scenario for Mark to coast the rest of the season. And he's still going to win some more races. You know, that much is certain. So, I mathematically, sure, there's still a chance for everyone else. Based off of what we've seen in the first half of the year, there is no chance for anyone else to win this championship.
It's looking bleak, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Marco Bezzecchi is fourth in the championship, and yet I am seeing him more and more competitive than Pecco has been.
Yeah.
And now he's leading the charge. You know, it's a big point gap, but you never know. Maybe he can continue to be there, second, third, maybe a win or two, maybe if Marquez makes a mistake, or maybe the situation doesn't pertain to Marquez winning. But there's a little bit of part of me in thinking about the likes of Cota. Mark was trying too hard to win that one. He even said himself he was pushing beyond that needed to be, and he made that mistake. Would he, or is the possible potential of him pushing too much in the Red Bull ring because he wants to prove a point?
Yeah, potentially, but potentially, and it could also just be that maybe he just accepts he's not going to win this year and just slots in behind Pecco, because it, you know, we've said this is an evolved version of the Honda Mark. So there's no reason to say that he wouldn't just settle. I don't think it's in him personally, but
yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
Yeah, I think that he genuinely is going to come with unrivaled pace. I don't think he's going to be in a position this year where he has to push to win or be at the front. I think he's just going to be at the front. There's no other two ways around it. He has the speed and the talent and the bike.
And I think it's going to be like sort of Catalunya. You could probably guarantee a Mark winning that one. It's home, front of the crowd. The crowd are going to love that. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be one hell of a scene to watch all the MM93 fans go crazy. And for Alex, don't forget. And something new like Balaton Park in Hungary. I think he'd be very, excuse the pun, he'll be very hungry to see if he can win there too. I think he'll be right up there trying to win, because who doesn't want to put their name and authority on a win on a brand new track? At least it is for MotoGP, it's concerned.
The first ever winner at a new circuit. Everybody wants that.
Of course. And I think you always want to put your name in that list, so I definitely think that. But the rest of the fight, I think, is going to be down to the likes of Marco Bezzecchi, Pecco Bagnaia. If Alex is getting bad habits and maybe the injury is serious than we thought, maybe P2 is not safe. Maybe yeah. Alex could drop down to third. Maybe Pecco gets some confidence. Maybe Marco Bezzecchi starts building. And I guess a final question then regarding title implications. Where do you see Jorge Martin finishing now? Where's realistic, do you think?
I think it's less about him finishing somewhere in the championship and more about him getting specific results, like a top five and then a top three and then challenge for the win, maybe try and win. I think the remainder of this year is assess where he is, assess where the Aprilia is, and see what can be done for next year to make a push for the title. I think Aprilia for sure are building there, and I don't think we're going to see significant jumps in performance from the Ducati because of the development freeze. This is basically for the other manufacturers, write the year off as testing.
Thinking about what are specific for Martin this season, do you think a podium is out of the equation?
No, not at all. He has the ability. And I think now they figured out the best way to ride that Aprilia. And yeah, I'm pretty sure Martin's one of those where he could look at Bez's data and go, okay, that's what I need to do. And figure out how to do it.
I was thinking to start small with a pole position or something like that. I could see that happening. Martin's excellent in qualifying.
Yeah.
I could definitely see that. And to think that he was already one of the... Not the also-rans, but he was in the mid-pack this weekend. And that was his first return back after some serious injury and a lot of depressing thoughts. You know, he even said he thought about retiring at one point because he was so battered and bruised. So you think coming back, yeah, maybe you're right then. I mean, maybe a win is out of the equation. Maybe that's a little bit too far. But if we can see a Martin podium, I think we would see some very emotional scenes from both him and Aprilia.
I think realistically, if he wants to challenge for the title next year, which I'm sure he will, he needs to kind of get that monkey off his back and get a podium this year. I'm not saying it'd be a failure if he didn't, but it would go a long way for his confidence and the self-belief to come back, you know? Look at what Mark's first win on the Ducati meant to him.
It was massive, wasn't it? It was big, big, big stuff. I mean, even his last win on the Honda was, I think it was, it might have been Misano. Even that was emotional. His return back from injury and he won in the Saxon Ring in 21, that was extremely emotional. So I do like to think that Martin can bounce back, but I wonder what it means for Bez. Because having the world champion in the other side of the garage, you've been the shining star all season, now all of a sudden your teammate's in. And coincidentally, this is the same rider who beat him for the world championship in 2018 for Moto3.
Yeah.
I think we're going to see a little bit more fire in Bez as well.
Well, for sure. And I mean, if these two play nicely and figure out how to work together as efficiently as they can, Aprilia could be a monster team next season.
Let me know what you guys think in the chat, in the comment section down below. Let us know, because I am curious what we think about Martin's chances, what Aprilia's chances are as well, especially going into the next season. But I guess we'll talk small and say, where do you think Martin will finish championship-wise at the end of the season? And do you think a podium is on offer for the world champion from Mallorca, I think he's from? I guess last thing to talk about then, Craig, is something that I guess is going to be quite subjective, which is a good thing because we can talk to the viewers. But let's discuss our winners and losers from this half of the season. And then we'll sort of look into the future when we get to the Red Bull Ring of Austria. So first things first, I've wrote a few names down. Of course, feel free to chuck in any names you you feel like. But a couple of names I'm going to give you right now. Marc Marquez. I know that was a surprise. But Marquez, 11 sprint wins, 8 victories, and leads the championship over 100 points. Enough said. And no end of pole positions. Alex Marquez, never expected him to be anywhere near this level of competition this season. Unbelievable season. Brilliant, brilliant stuff for Alex Marquez. Always liked him, and I'm pleased he's doing well. 10 sprint podiums, a sprint victory, 7 podiums, and a first Grand Prix win in Jerez. Marco Bezzecchi, of course, we just spoke about him. A win, 3 podiums, 2 sprint podiums, and quite honestly, an excellent first season, looking stronger all the time. What do you reckon then, Craig? Who have you got in there? I went for the easy ones, so apologise. It's down to you.
Yeah. No, that's fair enough. And yeah, I mean, you could have ended the list at winners being Marc Marquez because, yeah, his dominance has been unreal. But for sure, Alex has definitely stepped up his game this year and surprised a lot of people. And I was just thinking then he's now got a 3-week break. I think we could see him come back to Austria as he'd left off before the injury. Bez, I think, is just going to carry on building. I think Aprilia and him are realistic that they're not maybe there to contend every race, but they're certainly going to give it a good try. For me, I think Vinales has been a big winner. A lot of people wrote him off. A lot of people wrote the KTM switch off. But at times this year, we've spoken about it. He is the leading man in KTM. Leading Brad, leading Pedro, the Wonder Kid. And yeah, Nea hasn't really worked out for him until Bruno. And he showed again why he was, you know, the highly regarded rider that he is. But Matt, for sure, for me, was a standout up until the injury because you just sort of thought there's a rider getting to the end of his career. He's been through pretty much every team on that grid. Is this the final destination? He's left a factory team for a satellite team. Is this, you know, the final swan song? But he came out fighting. And I like Mav as a rider, and I follow him and his supporters group. And, yeah, his positivity this year is he's a different guy this year. Every hiccup is just a bump in the road for him, just another obstacle to jump over. You know, it's not the end of the world. We've seen him before, you know, his Yamaha days where things don't go how he expects and the toys get thrown out the car. So really impressed with Mav this year. And as far as winners, Agüero maybe from the start was impressive. And Aldeguer, once Agüero dropped off, Aldeguer took up the mantle as the best rookie. So the two rookies have been good. Two of the three. We'll get to the other one in a bit, I assume. And outside of that, it's not really Fabio. There's no denying Fabio's talent, but the rest of the Yamaha's results show you how much Fabio has talent. His, what was it, 3 poles in a row? I think definitely 4? Put him up in terms of...
3? Could have been 4. Might have been 3 and Marquez had 4. Yeah, I can't remember off the top of my head.
But yeah, for sure. Put himself in very high regard. Just the Yamaha's not there yet to deliver on a race performance.
So. I toyed with Fabio Quartararo because the first podium in 2 years, 4 poles of positions, it was 4 because I wrote it down. he's done excellent, but I really feel like in the races, the crashes, the mistakes, just really mars it a little bit because when you look at Fabio Quartararo's results, that there's nothing really that great about it for his standard, for a rider of his capabilities. But the Yamaha, he's doing unbelievable for what the Yamaha is expected. So in that instance, he does deserve to be in the winners list. But I don't think Fabio Quartararo would class himself as a winner from this season. I think he would be disappointed. And that's why I'm thinking maybe he doesn't fit the winners category because Yeah, four pole positions, lots of crash. I don't think he converted any of those pole positions into good results. That's the biggest surprise for me, is that, you know, every single time he had pole position, he tried, he tried, and it crashed, or something went wrong. You know, in Jerez, when he crashed trying to fight Marquez, and you think all those opportunities you had, even just to finish in the top five, were squandered. But because he's trying so bloody hard with a bike that clearly doesn't want to work. But the last few points I wanted to make as well is completely agree with Aldeguer and Agüero. The biggest thing there is Aldeguer was predicted. It was expected of him because he is on the GP24 Ducati. Yeah, makes sense. Agüero, I am surprised he's gone backwards. I didn't foresee that. I really felt that we would see this progression, what Raul Fernandez is doing, but the Japanese star in Agüero. So, a little bit unsure about them. And last ones I wanted to mention as well, the VR46 Ducati team. Both of those riders get criticised a lot. You know, maybe finished, Morbidelli should retire. They've actually had some very solid seasons. This season they've improved positions double, from 12th to 13th, where they were last sort of season, to now 6th and 5th, fighting against Marco Bezzecchi for 4th. They've been on the podium twice and one sprint between them as well, so pretty good stuff. It's not a winner's season, but it's an improvement. And the last thing I think I'll just quickly mention as well, Johan Zarco winning in Le Mans and a podium back-to-back. That's for me, that was the best part of the season.
Oh, for sure. And for everything that meant, you know, from how long has it been since Honda won a race and it was the satellite team that won? How many French people, world international people, were expecting Fabio to win the French Grand Prix that they'd forgotten about Zarco, and he won? How just poetic it was. It genuinely was incredible and couldn't have happened to a nicer, and yet I don't think anybody else in that paddock tries as hard as Zarco does. Even though it doesn't come across that Zarco tries very hard because he's just so relaxed and, you know, a rider's rider. He's not there to pick up sticks, you know, he's there to win. And he would have retired if he didn't think that he could. So, yeah, hats off to Zarco in those performances. And yeah, you know, to the point where not just those two results, the whole year, where people are saying, why isn't he on the factory bike?
Yeah, good point. But I will say about Johan Zarco being a battler, nothing proves this point more than he was once on the Caterham Moto2 project back in, what, 2013, 14? No, was it 2013 maybe? No one expected that to do well, and it didn't, you know? Yeah. And then he moved his way up, he got the results, he fought everything he could. He was one of those guys you really felt like, Jesus, that guy deserves a better bike. And when he did, two world championships. And then, of course, here he is now getting results on a Honda that is clearly not up to the scratch of the rest of them. Yeah, it was wet, but sure, he deserved it more than anyone else, and I don't think anyone would argue against it.
No, for sure. And it's almost like he needs to be the underdog to do well.
Yeah, true.
Like, that's his goal in life, is to prove people wrong.
Thankfully, I don't think many people actually think he's an underdog, so thankfully. I think a lot of people think he's all right. But I guess maybe if more people felt, Johan Zarco didn't deserve it, he's going to come in firing.
Yeah.
I guess we'll have to get onto the sad topic now. The losers. Do you want to start us off with a couple of losers? I mean, I did start off with Jorge Martínez just simply because he's had an injury, but please elaborate however you feel.
Yeah, look, and I mean, you know, for the nutcases who think that, there was a comment that was made, leave it to the journalists or something on one of the videos before, we're just a bunch of babblers or something along those lines.
Oh, yeah.
By all means, in saying someone is a loser, we don't mean that we could do any better. It's just
absolutely
they haven't
not.
Maybe achieved what we believe they're capable of and showed. So I was going to say Chantra, but now in thinking of it, he has done what you would normally expect of a rookie in his situation. If you look back at it, Chantra had a couple of wins in Moto2, and you could almost say he was a bit of a track specialist in the Moto2 category, in the sense that when it was his style of track, he was up there. And when it wasn't, he struggled a bit. So it makes sense that how he's getting on now, especially with being on a Honda that is still under the weather, and we don't know what version of the Honda he has, but I'm pretty sure it's not the same version that the other three have.
I think if you talk a satellite bike, it's the satellite of the satellite.
Yeah, it's the spare parts that were from the spare parts, you know. And yeah, it's only because of riders like Iagora in the beginning, who, you know, first race P4. Like Pedro Acosta, first season, challenging for wins. Like now, Aldeguer, first season, yes, he's on the Ducati, but challenging at the front. You have this expectancy that this is what a rookie will do. But the reality is, when most rookies come up, they struggle the first year and then build off it and go better. So, yeah, I think it's harsh to say Chantra's a loser within the first half of the season. I think he's just a rookie. He's just learning at the end of the day. And if he's fortunate enough to keep his seat for next year, then maybe you can be a bit more harsh if things don't improve. But for this season, I think he's plugging away. He's been plagued with arm pump, had that sorted out. Then he had an injury in training. I think someone we missed off as a winner was Taka Nakagami coming back as a wild card, as a retired, delivering there. But then Mir has to be considered there just purely based off of luck. Like, I don't think it's any fault of his own that he's had arguably one of the worst seasons I think anyone has ever had in the entirety of motorcycle racing. For that alone, it has to be there. But it's not through talent. It's not through a lack of drive or even that the Honda's bad. He's just really been unlucky this year.
I think he's been taken out 5 times, if I'm not mistaken.
And another one to throw into that scenario is Miguel Oliveira. Miguel never hurts himself. It's just when others take him out that he hurts himself. And then he has to come back from that. And even though he's on a Yamaha, if it's wet, you still would not rule him out. And he still has that ability within him. When the playing field's leveled, he's still there. I think he's struggling with the Yamaha. And I don't think he will be there next year, but this is the nature of the sport. And the tricky one, we discussed this, and I think it's maybe better for a public vote. Pecco Bagnaia. The expectation and what Mark has delivered on the same bike would make you think Pecco's had a really bad year and fully deserves to be in the loser basket. But the reality is Pecco's never started a year off well, and this has been one of the best starts to a season he's ever had. It's just that Mark is his teammate and done extremely better. So it's a really difficult one, and Pecco's overcome larger gaps before, and it's not completely out of the question. He's shown glimpses here and there. I think if you were to look at it in the sprint race, without doubt, he has gone missing. In the main race, he comes back. And so, yeah, it's a really 50-50 where does he sit in the winners and losers at the halfway point?
I made a few comments here because if compared to last season, the start, way better. Even the year when he won the championships, always better. Less retirements. He's had 2 retirements, yet he was taken out of one of them. So he only crashed out once by himself, which was, I think, in Silverstone, as we mentioned earlier, or at least we spoke off camera. He has been a solid rider this season. Last season, he threw away points like they were giving out sweets. It was ridiculous. He threw everything away, and it was hard to watch as a fan of Pecco, as a fan of the sport, and you think, come on, you need to be giving your best every single weekend. You can't be throwing points away like this. But he's not throwing points away. He's actually riding okay. But you cannot escape the constant problems he's having with that Ducati. It's every single week. It's more and more common now to see this disconsolate look on his face and the confusion that I don't know why this bike is not working like it was last season, for example. But I think, judging by the fact that he is in third, he's behind his teammate, still struggling with the Ducati, to think that the best team in MotoGP for the past 5 years, or 3 years, let's say, is still not finding a fix for his problem. I know a lot of people are going to say, well, that's Pecco's fault, but it sometimes it's not always as clear-cut as that. You know, I mentioned many times before, even the great Lorenzo had these problems. If the bike wasn't set up right, you just can't do it. But you set that bike up, and it's game over for the rest of the competition. So I think I would have to edge him slightly closer towards the losing list, unfortunately, for Pecco Bagnaia. Sorry, Craig, you want to say?
Yeah. No, more importantly with the Ducati problem is it's not that it's a Pecco problem. It's just Mark is capable of riding around it. But Mark still has the same problems. So there is very much a problem with that Ducati. Digi as well struggles, unless he can find a solution at one track by the end of the weekend. But in general, Digi has struggled, Fabio has struggled. Mark just finds a way around it.
Yeah.
But still has the issue. So for sure, Ducati have questions to answer, and maybe it's not so prominent because they've had such an advantage over the rest of the field.
Because this started in the testing in Sepang. Immediately, there was conversations that Mark and Pecco didn't like that bike, as we saw. Pecco says, this is not the same as the GP24. This is not as good. Where Mark was like, well, it's okay. We'll ride around it. We'll fix it. It's just a different type of rider. It's not to say that one's better or worse. It's just a different style. And I wouldn't mind betting that's probably happening with the likes of the Yamaha now. Quartararo is riding through those problems and doing everything he possibly can. Where the likes of Miguel Oliveira, completely lost. Well, yeah, and Alex Rins, absolutely lost. I am shocked to say that this project didn't work with Alex Rins on that. On the, I think, well, even when, you know, the inline four, was the idea was it was going to be the same as Suzuki, so he should be okay, and it's just never worked. And I can't believe that we're still talking about Alex Rins at this point with not hardly scoring any points to his name this season. He's a ghost in 2025.
Yeah, pretty much. And where on one hand you have Mir, who's either been taken out or crashed with his own doing and not scored many points, I think he's still ahead of Alex Rins, who hasn't really crashed out of any races.
No, he hasn't suffered any injuries this year either.
No, I mean, he still can barely walk without the assist of a crutch. And
oh, I didn't actually know that.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you see him hobbling on and off the bike, it's not pretty to watch. The leg break he had was pretty long-lasting, let's put it that way. I think he's found a way to manage on the bike, but his quality of life has definitely changed off the bike.
Because I think what a lot of people will forget about Alex Rins is, I've seen comments about Alex Rins and people saying, why is he even here? He should have won 2020 when Joan Mir won. You know, that was his best chance in that. If you look at the amount of championships that Alex Rins has finished runner-up to, you're talking around 5 championships from Moto3 to Moto2. And even in MotoGP, when he finishes a runner-up, a third place, I think it was, or second behind Joan Mir in 2020. Regardless, the guy's got talent. He is very, very talented. But he just can't seem to get around this Yamaha, and I don't know whether he will get another chance, unfortunately. And that's the sad reality, is I don't think he will get another chance in MotoGP. I'm hearing rumours that Jack Miller might be promoted to the factory Yamaha team.
Yeah, I think they're basically... Because Rins, I believe, still has another year on his contract, but I've heard that they're looking in to basically gardening leaving him. And paying him out either as a test rider or just to sit on the sidelines.
Oh, that's rough. I really like Alex Rins. I think it's a damn shame. I wish he got... I'd like to see him another bite just before we call it quits, though.
I think the thing with Yamaha is if you are respectful to them, they will repay in kind. And I don't think Yamaha are the type of company where just because Rins isn't performing for whatever reason it may be, that they get rid of him. They got rid of Vinales because of what he did. And it was seen as very disrespectful to the heads of Yamaha. I think with Rins, they will give him the years. But if there's talks of it being paid out, then I have a feeling that Rins has maybe had the conversation with Yamaha to say, I can't perform anymore, but I will, to honor the contract. And Yamaha have said, look, we appreciate it, and if you don't feel like you can ride at this level anymore, then we'll pay you out for the final year.
That's really sad. I mean, I don't know where he could go, to be fair, because I don't, do you just send him to World Superbike, or is the test riding option something to do? I don't know what Alex would want at that point, but for a rider who was so competitive to just end like this, it's a bit sad. I'm personally disappointed.
And the reality is it happens to a lot of people. You know, ultimately, it only takes one injury.
Yeah.
You know, and you can break yourself like Mark did and reposition your arm to accommodate for riding, but eventually it catches up with you. Eventually everything catches up with you. And Mark, for sure, is one headbang away from the diplopia being like permanent or something along those lines. So
it's a fine line we run, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
But it's basically Lorenzo retired. That he had the massive crash in Chang when he stamped in the rear brake and it launched him. I think it cracked his ankle again. God knows how many times he's cracked his ankle in his career. But that was the one where he then couldn't ride very well. He'd moved to the Honda, and of course the Honda project didn't work at all. So it was like, you know what, it's time to quit on a high, or time to quit while I still can.
Yeah.
So I guess that's our, again, we don't like saying it, but the losers of the pack, let's say. But let me know what you guys think. Let me know who your winners and losers are from the halfway point of the season. And I think that's about it, Craig. So have you got anything else you'd like to add to the conversation before we finish up today?
No, I mean, shout out to, I think his Pavlik, Milan Pavlik, who made a debut. I think someone, maybe Jack Hammer, can back up this statistic, but I think he may be one of the first Polish riders in the World Championship who wildcarded with the AGR team in Moto2. I'm sure there's got to have been one before, but equally it wouldn't surprise me if he was.
Oh, that's the trivia question today. Was Lukas Peszek Czech?
Yes.
Because he was in MotoGP. Polish rider. I feel like we've seen one before, but I really can't think off the top of my head. So that's a question for the viewers then. When was the last time we had a Polish rider? There definitely is one, isn't there? There's got to be.
There must have been. It's one of those things where you think there must have been at least one.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But, guys, thank you very much for watching this podcast here today, or listening, wherever you may be. From me and Craig, big thank you, and I guess we'll see you next time. So don't forget to like and subscribe, and ciao for now.